Welcome to Gima's Tales for Children. Each week, we visit a different part of the world to hear stories, legends, and myths. Some of these stories are so old that the origin has been lost in time. Some are new, and some are timeless. Join us this week as we travel to the Netherlands. More than one quarter of the country is below sea level. Great dikes have been built to keep out the North Sea. Instead of seagulls, there are beautiful swans who swim and fly throughout the Zuiderzee, as it is called. Dutch people are the tallest people in the world. Some scientists say it is because they have so much cheese, milk, and butter in their diet. Everyone thinks this is where tulips came from, but the Dutch people actually brought tulip bulbs from Turkey to the Netherlands hundreds of years ago. For information on the internet about the Netherlands for children, I suggest www.awesomeamsterdam.com. Our first story features a product which the Netherlands is famous for, their wonderful cheeses. Here is The Boy Who Wanted More Cheese. Claus van Bommel was a Dutch boy, 12 years old, who lived where cows were plentiful. He was over 5 feet high, weighed 100 pounds, and had rosy cheeks. His appetite was always good, and his mother declared his stomach had no bottom. His hair was of a color halfway between a carrot and a sweet potato. It was as thick as reeds in a swamp and was cut level from under one ear to another. Claus stood in a pair of timber shoes that made an awful rattle when he ran fast to catch a rabbit or scuffed slowly along to school over the brick road of his village. In summer, Claus was dressed in a rough blue linen blouse. In winter, he wore woolen breeches as wide as coffee bags. They were called bell trousers, and in shape were like a couple of cowbells turned upwards. These were buttoned on to a thick, warm jacket. Until he was 5 years old, Claus was dressed like his sisters. Then, on his birthday, he had boys' clothes with two pockets in them, of which he was proud enough. Claus was a farmer's boy. He had rye bread and fresh milk for breakfast. At dinner time, beside cheese and bread, he was given a plate heaped with boiled potatoes. Into these, he first plunged a fork and then dipped each round white ball into a bowl of hot melted butter. Very quickly, then, did potato and butter disappear. At supper, he had bread and skim milk left after the cream had been taken off, with a saucer to make butter. Twice a week, the children enjoyed a bowl of bonnyclabber or curds with a little brown sugar sprinkled on the top. But at every meal there was cheese, usually in thin slices, which the boy thought not thick enough. When Claus went to bed, he usually fell asleep as soon as a shock of yellow hair touched the pillow. In summertime, he slept till the birds began to sing at dawn. In winter, when the bed felt warm and Jack Frost was lively, he often heard the cows talking in their way before he jumped out of his bag of straw, which served for a mattress. The Van Bommels were not rich, but everything was shining clean. There was always plenty to eat at the Van Bommels' house. Stacks of rye bread, a yard long and thicker than a man's arm, stood on end in the corner of the cool, stone-lined basement. The loaves of dough were put in the oven once a week. Baking time was a great event at the Van Bommels, and no menfolks were allowed in the kitchen on that day unless they were called in to help. As for the milk pails and pans, filled or emptied, scrubbed or set in the sun every day to dry, and the cheeses piled up in the pantry, they seemed sometimes enough to feed a small army. But Claus always wanted more cheese. In other ways, he was a good boy, obedient at home, always ready to work on the cow farm, and diligent in school. But at the table, he had never enough. Sometimes his father laughed and asked him if he had a well or a cave under his jacket. Claus had three younger sisters, Trintje, Annetje, and Saartje. These, their fond mother, who loved them dearly, called her orange blossoms. But when at dinner Claus would keep on dipping his potatoes into the hot butter, while others were all through, his mother would laugh and call him her buttercup. But always, Claus wanted more cheese. One summer's evening, after a good scolding, which he deserved well, Claus moped and, almost crying, went to bed in bad humor. He had teased each one of his sisters to give him her bit of cheese, and this, added to his own slice, made his stomach feel as heavy as lead. Claus's bed was up in the garret. When the house was first built, one of the red tiles of the roof had been taken out, and another one, made of glass, was put in its place. In the morning, this gave the boy light to put on his clothes. At night, in fair weather, it supplied air to his room. A gentle breeze was blowing from the pine woods on the sandy slope not far away, so Claus climbed up on the stool to sniff the sweet piney odors. He thought he saw lights dancing under the tree. One beam seemed to approach the roof hole, and coming nearer played round the chimney. Then it passed to and fro in front of him. It seemed to whisper in the air as it moved by. It looked very much as if 100 fireflies had united their cold light into one lamp. Then Claus thought that the strange beams bore the shape of a lovely girl, but he only laughed at himself at the idea. Pretty soon, however, he thought the whisper became a voice. Again he laughed so heartily that he forgot his moping and the scolding his mother had given him. In fact, his eyes twinkled with delight when the voice gave this invitation. "There's plenty of cheese. Come with us." To make sure of it, the sleepy boy now rubbed his eyes and cocked his ears. Again the light-bearer spoke to him. "Come." Could it be? He had heard old people tell of the ladies of the wood that whispered and warned travelers. In fact, he himself had often seen the fairy's ring in the pine woods. To this, the flame lady was inviting him. Again and again, the moving cold light circled round the red tile roof, which the moon, then rising and peeping over the chimneys, seemed to turn into silver plates. As the disk rose higher in the sky, he could hardly see the moving light that had looked like a lady, but the voice, no longer a whisper as at first, was now even plainer. "There's plenty of cheese. Come with us." "I'll see what it is anyhow," said Claus, as he drew on his thick woolen stockings and prepared to go downstairs and out without waking a soul. At the door, he stepped into his wooden shoes. Just then the cat purred and rubbed up against his shins. Then he sped to the pine woods and towards the fairy ring. What an odd sight! At first Claus thought it was a circle of big fireflies. Then he saw clearly that there were dozens of pretty creatures, hardly as large as dolls, but as lively as crickets. They were as full of light as if lamps had wings. Hand in hand they flitted and danced around the ring of grass, as if this was fun. Hardly had Claus got over his first surprise, then of a sudden he felt himself surrounded by the fairies. Some of the strongest among them had left the main party in the circle and come to him. He felt himself pulled by their dainty fingers. One of them, the loveliest of all, whispered in his ear, "Come, you must dance with us." Then a dozen of the pretty creatures murmured in chorus, "Plenty of cheese here, plenty of cheese here. Come, come." Upon this, the heels of Claus seemed as light as a feather. In a moment, with both hands clasped in those of the fairies, he was dancing in high glee. It was as much fun as if he were at the kermis with a row of boys and girls, hand in hand, swinging along the streets, as Dutch maids and youth do during kermis week. Claus had not time to look hard at the fairies, for he was too full of the fun. He danced and danced all night, and until the sky in the east began to turn, first gray and then rosy. Then he tumbled down, tired out, and fell asleep. His head lay on the inner curve of the fairy ring, with his feet in the center. Claus felt very happy, for he had no sense of being tired, and he did not know he was asleep. He thought his fairy partners who had danced with him were now waiting on him to bring him cheeses. With a golden knife, they sliced them off and fed him out of their own hands. How good it tasted! He thought now he could and would eat all the cheese he had longed for all his life. There was no mother to scold him or daddy to shake his finger at him. How delightful! But by and by he wanted to stop eating and rest a while. His jaws were tired. His stomach seemed to be loaded with cannonballs. He gasped for breath. But the fairies would not let him stop, for Dutch fairies never get tired. Flying out of the sky, from the north, south, east, and west they came, bringing cheeses. These they dropped down around him until the piles of the round masses threatened first to enclose him with a wall and then to overtop him. There were the red balls from Edom, the pink and yellow spheres from Gouda, and the gray loaf-shaped ones from Laden. Down through the vista of sand in the pine woods, he looked and, oh, horrors! There were the tallest and strongest of the fairies rolling along the huge, round, flat cheeses from Friesland, and any one of these was as big as a cartwheel and would feed a regiment. The fairies trundled the heavy discs along as if they were playing with hoops. They shouted hilariously as, with a pine stick, they beat them forward like boys at play. Farm cheese, factory cheese, Alkmaar cheese, and, to crown all, cheese from Limburg, which Klaus could not bear because of its strong odor. Soon the cakes and balls were heaped so high around him that the boy, as he looked up, felt like a frog in a well. He groaned when he thought the high cheese walls were tottering to fall on him. Then he screamed, but the fairies thought he was making music. They, not being human, do not know how boys feel. At last, with a thick slice in one hand and a big hunk in the other, he could eat no more cheese, though the fairies, led by their queen, standing on one side or hovering over his head, still urged him to take more. At this moment, while afraid that he would burst, Klaus saw the pile of cheeses as big as a house topple over. The heavy mass fell inwards upon him. With a scream of terror, he thought himself crushed as flat as a Friesland cheese. But he wasn't. Waking up and rubbing his eyes, he saw the red sun rising on the sand dunes. Birds were singing, and the cocks were crowing all around him, in chorus, as if saluting him. Just then, also, the village clock chimed out the hour. He felt his clothes. They were wet with dew. He sat up to look around. There were no fairies, but in his mouth was a bunch of grass, which he had been chewing lustily. Klaus never would tell the story of his night with the fairies, nor has he yet settled the question whether they left him because the cheese house of his dream had fallen or because daylight had come. But from that day on, Klaus never asked for cheese. He'd eaten enough on that one enchanted night to last him forever. The next story is quite whimsical. Here is The Goblins Turned to Stone. The Dutch loved to make cheese and eat it every day. They liked it, whether it was raw, cooked, toasted, sliced, or in chunks. Soon it became the fashion to have cheese parties. Men and women would sit around the fire by the hour, nibbling the toast that had melted cheese poured over it. But after they had gone to bed, some of them dreamed. Now, some dreams may be pleasant, but cheese dreams were not usually of this sort. This was called a nightmare, or in Dutch, a nachtmerrie. In those days, instead of seeking for the trouble inside or asking whether there was any connection between nightmares and too hearty eating of cheese, the Dutch fathers laid it all on the goblins. The goblins, or sooty elves, that used to live in Holland were ugly, short fellows, very smart, quick in action, and able to travel far in a second. They were first cousins to the kabouters. They had big heads, green eyes, and split feet like cows. They were so ugly that they were ordered to live underground and never come out during the day. If they did, they would be turned to stone. The goblins had a bad reputation for mischief. They liked to have fun with human beings. They would listen to the conversation of people and then mock them by repeating the last word. A lot of echoes certainly were goblins repeating words. The ruler of the goblins lived beneath the earth. His palace was made of gold and glittered with gems. He had riches more than men could count. The most wonderful thing about these dwarves was the way in which they made themselves invisible. This was a little red cap which every goblin possessed and which he was careful never to lose. The red cap acted like a snuffer on a candle to put it out, and while under it no goblin could be seen by mortal eyes. Now it happened that one night, as a dear old lady lay dying in her bed, a middle-sized goblin, with his red cap on, came in through a crack into the room and stood at the foot of her bed. Just for mischief, and to frighten her by making himself visible, he took off his red cap. When the old lady saw the imp, she cried out loudly, "Go away, go away!" But the goblin dwarf only laughed at her with his green eyes. Calling her daughter, Elida, the old lady whispered in her ear, "Bring me my wooden shoes." Rising up in her bed, the old lady hurled the heavy clumps, one after the other, at the goblin's head. At this, he started to get out through the crack and away, but before his body was half out, Elida snatched his red cap away. Twirling the little red cap around on her forefinger, a brilliant thought struck her. She went and told the men her plan, and they agreed to it. This was to gather hundreds of farmers and townfolk, boys and men together, on the next moonlight night, and round up all the goblins in the county of Drenthe. By pulling off their caps and holding them till the sun rose, when they would be petrified, the whole brood could be turned into stone. So, knowing that the goblin would come the next night to steal back his red cap, she left a note outside the crack, telling him to bring several hundred goblins to the great moor. There, at a certain hour near midnight, he would find the red cap on a bush. With his companions, he could celebrate the return of the cap. In exchange for this, she asked the goblin to bring her a gold necklace. The moonlight night came round, and hundreds of the men of Drenthe gathered together. They were armed with horseshoes. It was agreed to move together in a circle towards the center, where the Lady Elida was to hang the red cap upon a bush. Then, with a rush, the men were to snatch off all the goblins' caps, pulling and grabbing, whether they could see or even feel anything or not. The placing of the red cap upon the bush in the center by the Lady Elida was the signal. So, when the great roundup narrowed to a small space, the men began to grab, snatch, and pull. Putting their hands out in the air, at the height of about a yard from the ground, they hustled and pushed hard. In a few minutes, hundreds of red caps were in their hands, and as many goblins became visible, they were indeed an ugly host. Yet hundreds of other goblins escaped, with their caps on, and were still invisible. The racket kept up till the sky in the east was gray. Had all the goblins run away, it would have been well with them. Hundreds of them did, but the others were so anxious to help their fellows or to get back their own caps, fearing the disgrace of returning headbare to their king and getting a good scolding, that the sun rose suddenly on them, and before they knew it, it was day. At the first level ray, the goblins were all turned to stone. The treeless, desolate land, which a moment before was full of struggling goblins and men, became as quiet as the blue sky above. Nothing but some rounded rocks or stones, in groups, marked the spot where the bloodless battle of imps and men had been fought. There these stones, big and little, lie to this day, among the buckwheat and the potato blossoms of the summer, under the shadows and clouds and whispering breezes of autumn, or covered with the snows of winter, they are seen on desolate heaths. Over some of them oak trees centuries old have grown. Others are near or among the farmers' grain fields or not far from houses and barnyards. The cows wander among them, knowing nothing of their past. And the goblins, well, they come no more. This last story truly stretches the imagination, particularly the ending, but I invite you to visit the Netherlands to see if the monument still is there in memory of the woman with 366 children. Now there was once a fine lady, a countess, who lived with her husband, the count, in the beautiful area known today as The Hague. She was childless and very jealous of other women who were mothers and had children playing around them. One day, when a beggar woman with her two babies on her back came along, the grand lady was in an unusually bad temper. For all her pretty clothes, she was not a person of fine manners. Although she had cradles and nurses and lovely baby clothes all ready, there was no baby. This spoiled her disposition so that her husband and the servants could hardly live with her. The countess had gone out to walk in front of her house after dinner. It was the third day of January, but the weather was mild. There, walking towards her, was the beggar woman, with two babies on her back and their arms round her neck, crying with hunger, trudging along the roadway. She saw the countess in front of her house and asked her for food or a penny. She expected surely at least a slice of bread, a cup of milk, or a small coin. But the countess was rude to her. She even burst into a bad temper and reviled the woman for having two children instead of one. The beggar woman replied, "Indeed, madam, they are both my children and born on one day. They have one father, but he is dead. He was killed in the war while serving his grace, your husband."
"Don't tell me such a story," snapped back the countess, now in a fury. "I don't believe that anyone, man or woman, could have two children at once. Away with you." And she seized a stick to drive off the poor woman.
Now it was the turn of the beggar to answer back. Both had lost their temper.
"Heaven punish you, you wicked, cruel, cold-hearted woman," cried the mother.
The countess now called her men-servants to drive the beggar away. This they did, most brutally. As she turned away, the poor mother, taking each of her children by its back, one in each hand, held them up before the grand lady and cried out loudly so that all heard her.
"May you have as many children as there are days in the year!"
Now, with all her wrath burning in her breast, what the beggar woman really meant was this. It was the 3rd of January, and so there were but 3 days in the year so far. She intended to say that, instead of having to care for two children, the countess might have the trouble of rearing three, and all born on the same day. But the fine lady in her mansion cared nothing for the beggar woman's words. Why should she? She had her lordly husband, and she was rich, and it was with great joy, and without a thought to what the poor woman had said, that she discovered she was going to have a child soon after that unhappy encounter. By the time summer had come, according to the fashion in all good Dutch families, all sorts of pretty baby clothes were made ready. Plenty of lace and pink and blue ribbons, pink for a girl and blue for a boy, were kept at hand. It was real fun to think over the names, and finally the countess had narrowed it down to 46. But before the sun set on the expected day, it was neither one boy nor one girl, nor were all the 46 names chosen sufficient, for the beggar woman's wish had come true, in a way not expected. There were as many as, and no fewer children than, there were days in the year, and since this was leap year, there were 366 little folks in the house. Yet none of these wee creatures was bigger than a mouse. Beginning at daylight, one after another appeared, first a girl and then a boy, so that after the 48th, the nurse was at her wits' end to give them names. It was not possible to keep the little babies apart. The 31 servant maids of the mansion were all called in to help in sorting out the girls from the boys, but soon it seemed hopeless to try to pick out Peter from Henry or Catalina from Annetje, so they gave up the attempt in despair. Besides, the supply of pink and blue ribbons had given out long before, after the first dozen or so were born. As for the baby clothes made ready, they were of no use, for all the garments were way too big. It was not likely such small human beings could live long, so the good Bishop Guy of Utrecht, when he heard that the beggar woman's curse had come true in so unexpected a manner, ordered that the baby should be all baptized at once. The Count, who was strict in his ideas of both custom and church law, insisted on it too. So nothing would do but to carry the tiny infants to church. How to get them there was such a question. The whole house had been rummaged to provide things to carry the little folks in, but the supply of trays and mince pie dishes and crocks was exhausted at the 360th baby. So there was left only a round glazed earthen dish, fluted and carved, which looked like a turban from Turkey. Into this, the last batch of babies, six little girls, were stowed. Curiously enough, number 366 was an inch taller than the others. To 30 housemaids was given a tray, for each was to carry 12 babies, and one the last six in the earthen dish. Instead of rich silk blankets, a wooden tray and no clothes on must suffice. The bishop was waiting with his assistants, holding brass basins full of holy water for the christening. All the town, including the dogs, were out to see what was going on. Many boys and girls climbed up on the roofs of the one-story houses
or in the trees to get a better view of the curious procession, the like of which had never been seen in The Hague before. Neither has anything like it ever been seen since. So the parade began. First went the count, with his captains and the trumpeters blowing their trumpets. These were followed by the men-servants, all dressed in their best Sunday clothes, who had the crests and arms of their master, the count, on their back and breasts. Then came on the company of 31 maids, each one carrying a tray, on which were 12 tiny babies. 20 of these trays were round and made of wood, lined with velvet, soft and smooth, but 10 were earthenware, oblong in shape, like a manger. In these, every year, were baked the Christmas pies. At first, all went on finely, for the outdoor air seemed to put the babies asleep, and there was no crying. But no sooner were they inside the church than about 200 of the brats began wailing and whimpering. Pretty soon they set up such a squall that the count felt ashamed of his progeny, and the bishop looked very unhappy. To make matters worse, one of the maids, although warned of the danger, stumbled over the helmet of an old crusader carved in stone that rose some 6 inches or so above the floor. In a moment she fell and lay sprawling, spilling out at least a dozen babies. She cried out as she rolled over, "Have I killed them?" Happily, the wee ones were thrown against the long-trained gown of an old lady walking directly in front of her, so that they were unhurt. They were easily picked up and laid on the tray again, and once more the line started. Happily, the bishop had been notified that he would not have to call out the names of all the infants, that is, 366, for this would have kept him at the solemn business all day long. It had been arranged that, instead of any on the list of the chosen 46 to be so named, all the boys should be called John and all the girls Elizabeth. So, after the first 6 trays full of wee folks had been sprinkled, one at a time, with holy water, the bishop decided to asperse them, that is, shake them from a mop or brush, the holy water, on a tray full of babies at one time. Yet it was evident that such tiny people could not bear what healthy babies of full size would think nothing of. Whether it was because of the damp weather or the cold air in the brick church or too much excitement, or because there were not 366 nurses or milk bottles ready, it came to pass that every one of the weak creatures died when the sun went down. Just where they were buried is not told, but there is, in one of the Hague churches, a monument in honor of these little folks who lived but a day. It was graven with portraits in stone of the count and countess and told of their children, as many as the days of the year. Nearby are hung up the 2 basins in which the holy water used by the bishop in sprinkling the babies was held. The year, month, and day of the wonderful event is also engraved. To this day, many people from various lands still come to visit the tomb of the 366 babies. So, we've come to the end of our time together today. If you have a story you'd like to hear, please feel free to write me with your request. If you've written a children's story and would like to share it, let me know as well. I welcome your feedback. You can email me at guima@kciw.org. That's guima@kciw.org. See you next week. Same time, same place, but very different stories. We'll travel to the Indian Ocean to hear mystical tales from the island of Sri Lanka and India, land of spices, painted elephants, and great tigers who rule the jungle. This is Guima saying goodbye and happy reading.